Hundreds of millions of people are going to die. That's a fact.
Hundreds of millions of people will die. How?
Global warming.
Says the end of the world is coming.
That's what we need, another nut job walking the streets.
Two armed forces are racing toward us from the future. One is peak oil, the end of the oil age. The other is climate change, which will hit us first and worst. Meanwhile, and not unrelated, our economy is collapsing. How shall we spend the last of our resources? Canadian author and scholar Thomas Homer Dixon works through these questions in his presentation to a group of British parlementarians. It was May 6, 2009, to the all-party parliamentary group on peak oil and gas. The topic, responding to the converging crisis of the 21st century. Of course, the British government cannot afford good technical help in these economic times. As Professor Homer Dixon moves to his slides, the audio booms with too many echoes for straight radio broadcast, so I can't play it for you. I've noticed the same in the American capital, where the off-site audience almost invariably gets amateur to bad audio on webcasts or net postings. Ditto Al Gore's important speech from Poznan, we couldn't hear that. Critical climate and energy information doesn't get passed on due to poor recording techniques, and that's the sad truth. So I'm going to hit a few of the high notes from this important speech by Homer Dixon. I'll point you to my Radio EcoShock blog for June 11th, where you will find links to download the entire speech, the Q&A session, and the accompanying slides. Just click on blog at ecoshock.org and you'll be there. Thomas Homer Dixon is the author of The Upside of Down and The Ingenuity Gap. We carried an interview with him on the EcoShock show for February 13th, 2009. You can download that from our archives. The interview previewed Homer Dixon's new book, Carbon Shift: How the Twin Crises of Oil Depletion and Climate Change Will Define the Future. That was released in Canada in April. Now get more solid details in this new speech to the British legislators. Thomas is one of the big-scale thinkers, with a mind that can stretch across many different academic disciplines. He has a talent for developing a coherent picture out of the fog. We always learn from him not just facts, but ways to describe these big new changes arriving almost daily. And that is the problem, isn't it? We're saturated with new information, some of it conflicting, all of it about change. Homer Dixon explains a new model being used by top scientific institutions and eventually by governments will look inside this power technique. Let's start with our original question, peak oil or climate change? Of course, it turns out these two are closely interconnected. New energy like solar or wind could help solve both. But turning to cheap, abundant coal could also be a solution for just oil shortages. We might convert the coal into gas. That has been done already. We know the technique. But the coal option is disastrous for the other one, for climate. It floods the atmosphere and the ocean with excess carbon dioxide. Even Homer Dixon seems torn on this issue. On the one hand, along with Canadian energy whiz Mark Jacquard, Thomas warns that, faced with ever-increasing oil and gas costs, countries like the United States, China, and India will turn to coal again. This runs completely counter to what we thought was happening. All sorts of theorists agreed that the world was decarbonizing its energy supplies, moving up the ladder to cleaner fuels. The United Kingdom, for example, closed down its dirty coal industry in favor of new North Sea gas supplies, a cleaner fuel. From coal to oil to gas and then to renewable energies, that was the mantra of energy economists. I would add that the problem with coal applies to America as well. For all his climate-friendly appointments, Barack Obama has not ordered an end to mountaintop removal for coal, or even a rapid cutback of this atmospheric poison. The latest climate bill, Waxman-Markey, went soft on the coal lobby, I'm sorry to say, and on the millions of Midwestern Democrats who rely on coal for up to 95% of their electricity.
Mr. Peabody's coal train has hauled it away.
Peabody's the world's largest coal producer. In 2004 alone, the company sold 227 million tons of coal, reaping revenues of $3.6 billion. With operations throughout the Intermountain West, Appalachia, the Midwest, Australia, and Venezuela, Peabody Energy fuels more than 10% of all U.S. electricity and supplies 3% of the entire world's electrical needs.
Mr. Peabody's coal train has hauled it away.
Now, as conventional oil peaks, Homer Dixon warns we are recarbonizing, going to dirty tar sands and back to more and more coal. Despite what we know about climate threats, the world is recarbonizing with coal, driven by rising prices and shrinking supplies, in other words, by peak oil. Homer Dixon suggests the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change will have to add peak energy problems to its research and reports as one problem merges with the other. Thinkers like Jacquard and Homer Dixon accept more coal use as immoral and yet inevitable. We cannot control China's coal use, and the Chinese show no inclination to do so. Therefore, Homer Dixon says to the British politicians, and in his book Carbon Shift, we will have to develop real clean coal technology, certainly more efficient furnaces to start, but then a combination of pumping carbon back into the ground and a new, unproven technology of turning coal into gas in sealed underground facilities. Personally, I think this is folly. After a few more environmental disasters, crop failures driven by heat and drought, cities destroyed by violent storms or new insect plagues, eventually, whole populations will react angrily to coal as the climate killer that it is. The reaction may begin as boycotts and protests, but it could turn as nasty as destructive rebellions. I could even see the day when renegade coal plants are bombed, perhaps the subject of wars, just to stop escalating climate disorders. Clean coal is sort of like helpful heroin. It's black death for the planet, I say. Okay, it's a contentious issue. Thomas Homer Dixon says the dance between peak oil and climate disruption illustrates a larger misunderstanding in our thinking, and this is the model I was talking about. Most of us continue to consider one problem at a time with many proposed solutions. In fact, says Homer Dixon and the new academia, we need to comprehend complex systems. Our civilization and nature itself is a maze of interconnected complex systems. We set out to change one situation and something completely unexpected shifts in a way we never considered. It is, to paraphrase one of the world's worst statesmen, an unknown unknown. That means we cannot manage the real world. Let's spend a little time with Homer Dixon on this because our future survival may depend upon getting reality right. These are clips taken from the UK speech.
Now, a general conceptual point I want to make before I start talking specifically about climate change and energy is the need to shift our view of the world. And in many ways, I think this is the most fundamental argument I've been trying to make for many years now. We need to shift our view of the world from seeing it as composed of machines to seeing it as composed of complex systems. So we'll spend a little bit of time unpacking this idea. When I talk about this with my students, I take a wind-up, 1920s wind-up mantle clock into class, and I put it on my desk, and I say, I can take this thing apart. I can break it down into its bits and pieces, its bushings and its screws and its cogwheels and springs and things. And I can understand how those pieces work together very precisely. And if the clock isn't working properly when I put all the pieces back together in the right places, I can usually attribute the problem to one piece. I can say there's the problem. And it makes sense. It makes sense to say that the clock isn't working properly. That is a statement that has content. All of those things really don't happen or aren't true with complex systems. I would argue that one of the challenges that we face in this world, and in fact one of the contributors to our recent economic crisis, is that people have thought that we were working in a world of machines, and we're actually working in a world of complex systems. So whereas machines can be taken apart, they can be analyzed, and they can be fully understood, they are ultimately no more than the sum of their parts. And whereas they exhibit normal, I sound like I'm proposing a bill in those comments, whereas they exhibit normal or equilibrium patterns of behavior, as I was suggesting again with that clock. And critically, they show proportionality between cause and effect. Small causes cause small effects, big causes cause big effects. And as a result, machines can be managed because their behavior is predictable. With complex systems, we have a very different situation. They exhibit emergent properties. They are more than the sum of their parts. You put the pieces together and they start doing things that you don't expect, even if you have complete knowledge of all the parts. They can flip from one pattern of behavior to another. They have what are called multiple equilibria. And in the world economy, we've seen a flip from a stable state to a turbulent state. It's quite possible that the climate has multiple equilibria too. And this is as a result fundamentally because they show disproportionality between cause and effect. Their behavior is often what is called by specialists non-linear. Small causes can cause big effects, and sometimes big causes or big changes in the system don't really do much at all. And because of all these things, complex systems cannot be easily managed because the behavior is unpredictable. And what this means is that we are moving fundamentally from a world of risk to a world of uncertainty that's populated by unknown unknowns.
My takeaway is, we develop models of reality by focusing on certain problems. The economy, the energy system, our food supply, population. In fact, each of these are finely balanced in time and heavily interconnected. For example, new research shows climate systems are far more fragile and unstable than we thought. Even a relatively small change in atmospheric gases can trigger massive changes, from a glacial world to a tropical one. Likewise, in agriculture, a change of less than 2 degrees or a sudden heat wave can remove some of the most productive rice and wheat growing areas in the world, and all of that can happen within a single lifetime or two. We've just learned about this climate sensitivity and rapid shifts from exhaustive scientific exploration done in the last decade. No wonder the wider public hasn't realized our precarious situation. It took several centuries for the average person to accept Galileo's assertion that the Earth revolves around the sun, contrary to our sense of the sun rising. We don't have a century to communicate the decline of oil and the coming climate chaos. Both are already upon us. And this time now, it's just the easy beginning.
The last time the temperature of the planet was 2 degrees above the 1900 level was 130,000 years ago. That was during the last interglacial period, or period between glaciations. And sea levels at that point were 4 to 6 meters higher than they are today, largely because of the melting of Greenland. The last time the temperature of the planet was 3 degrees above the 1900 level was 30 billion years ago. Now that's where 3 degrees is where we're projected to be in this relatively conservative estimate by the end of this century. It's 30 million years ago, and sea levels at that time were 20 to 30 meters higher than they are today. And think about the implications of that for London. Now, as we'll see later in my presentation, if we get the 3 degrees, it's extremely unlikely, without direct intervention in the atmosphere, by that I mean geoengineering, it's extremely unlikely if we get to 3 degrees that we're going to be able to ratchet the temperature back. So we will be committing the planet over a period of time. This kind of melting takes hundreds of years potentially, but we will be committing the planet to sea level rise in the tens of meters, easily within a historical period that will be shorter than, for instance, the existence of the London in human history to this point. Much shorter.
As regular listeners know, I've been harping away at the dangers climate shift poses to our food supply. One factor is crop burnout. The year may be or may not be particularly hot, but just a week or two of superheat can wipe out crops meant to feed many millions of people. Thomas Homer Dixon summarizes new research on this very problem.
For global food production, this is a paper that was released in Science in January, which I found particularly important. What these researchers did is they started from the premise that many of our crops, our most important food crops like wheat and corn and rice, are very susceptible to short periods of very high temperature of over 40 or 42 degrees. You get a precipitous decline in yield, they basically die. So you want to know what the probability of very high temperatures during the summer might be in the future. So what they did is they went out to 2040 to 2060, And they asked, what is the probability of any summer during that period of time in a particular region being warmer than any summer to record, any summer on record to date? So just to give you an example, here in North America, there are three areas in particular, Florida, Arizona, and California, which are critically important food-producing regions for Canada. During the winter, we get a lot of our food from those regions. And if you can see that they're in orange, and to read the diagram, it means you've got a 70-90% chance, according to these models, that any given summer between 2040 and 2060 will be warmer than the warmest summer on record between 1900 and 2006. Okay, so significant probability of heat shock. Now, you might say, well, okay, it looks like the world is warming, but it looks manageable. Let's go out towards the end of the century. Now, this is 2080 to 2100, the time when we have not 6.7 but 9 billion people on the planet. Very large areas of the planet, including critical food-producing regions where about 40 to 45% of the world's population lives, East Asia and South Asia, have a 90 to 100% chance that any given summer will be warmer than the warmest summer on record between 1900 and 2006. Now, as a political scientist who studied the relationship between environment and conflict, I look at that map and I see that's a prescription, not only for food catastrophe, but for social catastrophe across the planet. And that was exactly what the authors suggested. They said we need to get going now, as quickly as possible, to be developing food grains that can withstand severe drought and severe heat. It turns out it takes a long time to develop those grains.
From the heart of San Francisco and going out to all America, this is Green 960 AM, the Radio EcoShock Show. Homer Dixon foresees a climate-caused calamity in northern China. The change in the Arctic may mean monsoon rains don't reach North China to the wheat fields, but instead flood the south. This could lead not just to widespread hunger, but political instability in the world's most populous nation. He brings up an open question between two leading economists, Harvard's Martin Weitzman and Yale's Bill Nordhaus, on the so-called fat tail debate. The fat tail is a widening in model predictions of global heating beyond the limits discussed by today's politicians and even mainstream environmental groups. Some models predict a real possibility of warming of 5 or 6 degrees Celsius or even higher. Homer Dixon does not say that a warming of over 5 degrees by the end of this century likely means mass extinction for most mammals. But he does admit such changes could at least mean the end of human civilization. My friends, scientists are now debating whether we can survive our greenhouse gas pollution. The second part of this one-hour speech is about the relationship between fossil fuels, especially oil, and our increasing population. There is no way to support 6 billion people, much less the predicted 9 billion, without a lot of affordable oil. But the world's major oil fields are in decline, and we are not discovering anywhere near enough oil and gas to replace what we are using. Oil will decline, perhaps steeply, within 20 years, and what will we do then? Homer Dixon thinks humans will find a way to burn coal underground, keeping emissions below the earth, and converting that coal to useful gas. The cleaner gas would then fuel electric generating plants, perhaps for an all-electric transportation system and general industrial needs. He also predicts we will turn to geoengineering in a last attempt to preserve the Arctic and the general climate. Nuclear power would also be part of his mix. All that is set against the real background of continually growing fossil fuel emissions. Even by 2006, our greenhouse pollution was already beyond the worst scenario considered in the latest Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report. Every bit of CO2 commits us to at least another century of climate change, if not more.
The climate change that takes place due to increases in carbon dioxide. Now, this is a paper that just came out about 2 months ago. Climate change that takes place due to increases in carbon dioxide concentrations is largely irreversible for 1,000 years after emissions stop. Following cessation of emissions, removal of atmospheric carbon dioxide decreases radiative forcing, but it is largely compensated by slower loss of heat to the ocean, so that the atmospheric temperatures do not drop significantly for at least 1,000 years.
Our very own 1,000-year Reich of heat. In his question and answer period with UK legislators, Thomas Homer Dixon finds an underlying economic cause, our need for never-ending growth. He says that is a fatal fantasy, which must end, being replaced by some sort of steady-state economy. The market may turn into cooperatives. Population, he says, is also driving climate change, saying that 20% of all children born today are unwanted. And finally, consumers must transform themselves into problem solvers with a better sense of the meaning of life. He sees no possible return to the old age of oil and its assumptions.
That's how it was at the end of the age of oil.
You have stumbled into the Radio EcoShock Show with Alex Smith, right here on Green 960 AM, San Francisco. We've been reviewing a speech by author and professor Thomas Homer Dixon given to the All-Party Parliamentary Group on Peak Oil and Gas on May 6, 2009. The topic was Responding to the Converging Crises of the 21st Century. Find the full speech, Q&A, and slides at appgopo.org.uk. I'll spell that for you, appgopo.org.uk. Or find my Radio EcoShock blog entry for June 11th, 2009 at ecoshock.org. I'll put links there as well. Of course, you can download this and all our past programs as free MP3 files from our website. We have another speech by Thomas Homer Dixon in the 2008 program archive. Look for Climate, Who, If Not Us, with Thomas Homer Dixon, recorded in Toronto and broadcast March 20th, 2008 at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Our opening clip came from Val Kilmer's new movie, Steam Bath. Peabody Coal Facts from Making Contact at radioproject.org. Wrap-up music by David Rovix.
It was as if there was a contest to see how many holes could be dug, to see how much of it could be sucked from the ground, to kill off every beetle and bug, to kill off every woman and child, and to kill off every man. And they put it all in barrels, and they put the barrels into cans. That's how it was at the end of the age of oil. It was like a competition to see how big everything could get, from the highways to the strip malls to the giant TV sets, from the Moabs to the drag lines, monster trucks and SUVs, and the massive roaring chainsaws that cut down all the trees. That's how it was at the end of the age of oil. It was like they were trying to see how many garbage dumps they could fill, how many flagpoles could they squeeze onto a single windowsill, how many countries could be bombed, how much black gold could they drill, how much coal could they extract if they just blew up all the hills. That's how it was at the end of the age of oil.